Charlie, I believe, has been below the radar for many, many years. I'm not going to go through all his achievements, but his CV, I would say, is second to none.
Bunkrana man Jim McConnell is a man with a mission. He wants to bring someone back from the dead, or at least his memory and reputation. Charlie O'Hagan was also from Bunkrana, famous in his day as one of Ireland's soccer heroes, now largely forgotten and unknown.
Among the clubs he played for was Bunkrana, Derry Celtic, Tottenham Hotspur, Aberdeen, capped 11 times for Ireland. The big achievement was he went on then to manage Norwich and we managed Sevilla in Spain.
We were at a noisy FAI event in Letterkenny, part of its countrywide campaign to promote the ill-fated Euro 2020 Championships, with some games due to be played in Dublin. Jim McConnell has set up an exhibition showcasing some of Charlie's soccer memorabilia.
But just looking at the exhibits we have here, one of them does connect Charlie. I'm delighted to have this one, the Donegal Senior Shield. It was first played for in 1895 and Bunkrana won this competition in 1897. And Charlie, as a 16-year-old, played in that Bunkrana team. So I suppose after 120 years, we can say that we're reuniting Charlie's mementos along with the shield.
We'll hear more about that shield later. It is an important part of Bunkrana soccer history. Jim McConnell has been involved in local and national soccer all his life. The game, at youth and amateur levels, depends on the work and dedication of volunteers like Jim. We all had soccer heroes when growing up, and Charlie O'Hagan was one of Jim's.
Charlie was born in 1881 in the Souvenir House, which in Charlie's day would have been a thriving grocery business. I suppose my interest over the years was like a monkey in my bag. My grandmother lived directly across the street, which is now the Atlantic Bar. It was a hotel that time, the Atlantic Hotel, and the two families were very friendly. And I always wondered why he heard snippets of Charlie's career, but he wondered why he never got more accolades or given more credit for what he'd done, because it was an exceptional football career the man had.
Charlie was playing at a time when there was no internet, no TV, no radio, and film was just a rare, flickering, silent experience. If people travelled, it was mostly to emigrate, and when they did, they rarely came back. Newspapers and letters kept people informed and connected. There are many gaps in Charlie's story, times when he disappears only to suddenly pop up years later in unexpected places. Finding reliable information on Charlie proves difficult, finding people locally who are connected to him even more so.
Well, if you're talking about a blood connection, I don't know. But he was a great friend of my grandfather's and my granny's at the corner, West End corner, and he came from the Market Square area. And I remember my father saying they got a couple of letters from him.
The Tinney Doherty family are soccer royalty in Donegal. Danny Tinney was a fantastic goalkeeper who played with Derry City for many years. He worked tirelessly, coaching and promoting the game locally when his playing days were over. His son, Tony Tinney, no mean footballer himself, learned about Charlie from his father.
They were big business people. They had a big business going right down all sides of the town. They were just neighbours and friends. He was a great footballer, and my father then went on to be inspired by him. You know, although my father was a goalkeeper, Charlie O'Hagan was an outfield player.
What did you hear about him growing up?
My father's father would have known him. You're talking about the turn of the century. My father was just hearing chat about Charlie O'Hagan playing for Ireland, which is an unbelievable piece of work at that time.
The first experience I think we have written anywhere on Charlie was that at the age of 16 in 1897, he played for Bunkrana FC, who won the Donegal Senior Shield, played in Rathmullen. Incidentally, that shield is still in Bunkrana. It was kept out in the home of Eddie Doherty, out on Sidagny's Terrace, and his sister still looks after it, and it's in brilliant shape. For I would say maybe one of the oldest football trophies, not in Donegal, maybe in all Ireland.
There's a story behind that shield itself and why it's here in Bunkrana. Still here in Bunkrana?
There's possibly, I don't know, I didn't get into that, but they never let it go anyway. When you think about, you go back to 1897 and like the mode of transport at the time, they went by the Swallow, they went by sea. There used to be a rumour going about, I heard a few older people saying that they went over in the boat and come back a week later with a trophy.
The Bunkrana team went across the water anyway, they were playing in this Donegal final. There was a massive big crowd at the match, and the first match wasn't finished because there was a row and a ruction and had to be abandoned. And then there was a replay. The shield was the big prize, and that was a super prize that time. I heard my father say that the second match It was another blood and thunder game. They eventually won the match in the Kentucky and the boats. They got presented with the shield. And the shield is still in Peggy Doherty's house in St. Agnes Terrace in Buncrana. That shield never ever went back. And it's supposed to be left back the next year for the next competition, but it never went back.
Why did it not go back?
Well, they worked so hard to get it, and they had to put up a battle on the pitch, off the pitch, and all around the place to get the shield. So eventually they said, we have won this now, Wes. It'll never go back. And if they want it, they'll have to come and take it.
Charlie excelled as a young lad in 16, living at home with his mother and two of his brothers and two sisters in the grocery shop. Now, they must have been fairly well off, because Charlie then went to St. Columb's College, and I would say that that would have been a fee-paying place at the time. So I would say the business was pretty good. St. Columb's had an amateur team playing at the time called St. Columb's Court, and Charlie was playing for them in one of the local junior leagues. But I think in 1901, the new Irish League was starting up in St. Columb's Court. They entered the Irish League not too successfully. They found it really difficult. They were a bit out of their depth football-wise. But Charlie wasn't. Charlie excelled. So they pulled out of the league and they were replaced by a team called Derry Celtic. Charlie then played that first season with Derry Celtic. And at that time it was an All-Ireland league. But Charlie, and I think there's a thread run through his career, he was really impulsive. I think he had wandering feet and they took a notion Charlie would move. So the following season, Charlie went to Liverpool.
This is the beginning of Charlie's adventures and travels.
He went to work for a fruit importer in Liverpool. He didn't go firstly as a footballer. So he played for a local amateur team called St. Xavier's.
My great granny would be a first cousin of Charlie's. We first heard about Charlie through our mother. She would have talked about Charlie O'Hagan and playing for Ireland. So I was always known within our family.
Vincent Gallagher and his brother Raymond are distant relatives of Charlie's. Vincent has been researching Charlie's story for a while now and has filled in some of the gaps. When Charlie went to Liverpool, he already had a contact there.
He went to Liverpool through college, St. Xavier's College, around 1902. His brother James was based in Liverpool. He was about maybe 6 or 7 years older than Charlie, and he went to Liverpool probably based on the fact that his brother was actually working there. He attended college, and then he got on to the college team where he was first recognised, and then he got on to the Everton team. And James then was working as a fruit salesman, so Charlie worked in this company as well, and this company bought an oranges from Seville. So there was obviously like a connection there.
The fruit sales job and importing Seville oranges period will prove to be significant factors later on in Charlie's life. But for now, he's busy building his soccer reputation in Liverpool. Charlie is ambitious, but he's also restless, in a hurry to get to places, both physically and in his soccer career.
St. Xavier's, and again he showed his potential there, and he was approached and he signed for Everton. He was there about a year. He never made the first team. He signed for Everton, I think it was 1903. But the following year, somebody must have knew something about him, because a report came from Spurs, and he signed for Tottenham Hotspur.
The Athletic News, May 9th, 1904. At this period of the year, football matters must necessarily concern the movements of the players. At Everton, I'm rather surprised to hear that O'Hagan had gone to Tottenham. With the old Zavarians, he gained fame, and since his appearance at Goodison Park as a professional, he's developed wonderfully.
He became nearly an immediate success at Spurs. He formed a great bond with Jack Kirwan, a fellow Irish international. They proved a great team. That Jack Kirwan, by the way, went on to manage Ajax in Holland. He managed Livorno as well.
Charlie was making a name for himself at the highest levels of English soccer. London was the centre of the British Empire, and, just as they are today, Spurs were one of the biggest teams in it. As schoolboys, Vincent and Raymond Gallagher contacted the club.
My brother Raymond, he wrote off to Spurs late 87, and he then got back a letter. He basically asked him, had they any record of Charlie playing for Spurs? So it basically says that they got his name in a yearbook, and he signed for Spurs in 1904, beginning of the season, and he left at the end of 1906 season. They sent over a copy of the yearbook showing his picture and gave a description of where he was from and where he actually played, you know.
What age would you and Raymond been at that stage?
I was 11 and Raymond would have been 12.
Your Ipswich charity died away.
Oh, died away, aye.
But then it was resurrected again.
I was actually applying for a heritage grant to do up Barnshead. So I was building up like a history of our own old home place. I had memberships for British newspaper archives. Put in like a searching charity's name. A lot of stuff came up then. So it just kept coming up. So I built up a catalogue of stuff on them then. So that's where it sort of came about then again.
The Derry Journal, November 30th, 1904. The many friends of Mr. Charles O'Hagan of Mulcranna will be pleased to learn of his success in the English football circles this season. Mr. O'Hagan plays for Tottenham and on many occasions has been highly praised by football critics for his clever play. I'm told he has found the net oftener than many people suppose. In Football Chat of the same date, Mr. O'Hagan is also highly eulogised. The writer states, O'Hagan, I am told, sits up at night studying goal geography. And the fact that he has found the net on nearly 40 occasions this season is testimony to the value of his studies. Mr. O'Hagan, who formerly played for Derry Celtic, is a brother of the popular solicitor Mr. Philip O'Hagan of this city.
I don't want to repeat myself, but Charlie really done very well at Spurs. It was around that time as well that he won his first cap, 1905, against Scotland. That was in Belfast. It was a 2-2 draw. A month or two later, he played against Wales. He scored his first goal in that game. He got 11 caps altogether. But then, an impulsive part of Charlie came over and he moved to the North East and he signed for Middlesbrough.
My mother probably would have been second or third cousin of Charlie O'Hagan's.
Geraldine Gill is another distant relative of Charlie's through her mother, but she's also connected to her mother-in-law, who grew up for a period in the O'Hagan household.
All I know about Charlie O'Hagan is what my mother told me, that he was related to her and that Charlie O'Hagan was a great footballer of his time and he was one of the highest paid footballers at the time. And he was very well educated and he lived on the main street just beside the town clock in Buncrana. My mother-in-law was Bridget O'Donnell and her mother died when she was very young. And she spent a lot of her childhood in O'Hagan's kitchen. She lived up there a lot of the time and she told me that they had a beautiful house and they used to have a servant maid with little white dolly or whatever you call those things on their head and white penny, and they had a beautiful house and they appeared to be, you know, well-to-do.
The Londonderry Sentinel, October 31st, 1905. Charlie O'Hagan of Tottenham Hotspur, the old Derry Celtic player, who gave such a fine exhibition in the international with Wales at Cliftonville last season, the Mulcranna man has joined the increasing army of football press critics, being engaged by the Illustrated Mail to supply notes on current football topics each Saturday. This is the first occasion that a professional, who's appearing before the public each week, has received such an appointment, which speaks well for the estimation in which the Irish international is held in the metropolis.
Charlie is now at Middlesbrough. At a time when most people leave school barely able to read and write, Charlie is well educated, and this, along with his great skills on the pitch, make him an attractive prospect for clubs.
When he signed for Middlesbrough, he was actually taken on as well as the secretary of the club. So he was actually a player and a secretary. But maybe that was because Charlie was educated, and there's reports as well that he was the first professional footballer to actually write a column. There's a paper in London and he would write a weekly three-column piece and it was based around sports and athletics.
Charlie was a trailblazer in many ways, never afraid to take a chance, do things that hadn't been done before. Writing the column would encourage him to pursue a career in journalism later. But as always, Charlie was getting impatient.
So he went to Middlesbrough, but he struggled at Middlesbrough. And one of the reasons he struggled in Middlesbrough, he played a few games at the start, but then they signed a fella called Wolf Common, who was an England international footballer. He would have been one of the top players of his day and kept him out of his place on that Middlesbrough team. So within months, Aberdeen came knocking.
The Dundee Courier, December 20th, 1906.
I prepared my readers yesterday morning for the transfer of a leading English player, Charlie O'Hagan. The player will appear as partner to Lenny against Rangers at Pittodrie on Saturday. O'Hagan played for Ireland in all three international games last year. Previous to joining Middlesbrough, O'Hagan was with Tottenham and played many fine games for them. With such players as Common and Bloomer in the front line, O'Hagan's services were not required for the first league club of Middlesbrough, and this was the reason the Irishman desired a change.
My mother, she would have been a cousin of Charlie O'Hagan's, or maybe a second cousin.
Pat Deeney from Bunkrana is another relative of Charlie's, and he has some news for Tony Tinney.
And my great-grandmother then, she would have been an aunt of Charlie's. And then there was another sister in it as well. Her name was Susan, and she would have been mother to the famous footballer Danny Tinney, who played with Derry City and all the rest of them, you know. There is a strong family connection there, even though some of them don't know it.
I talked to Tony Tinney, and he reckoned that there was just a strong friendship between the families. He didn't actually realise that you're related.
No, and I double-checked that today on my cousin. She confirmed to me they were all the one family. They are blood relations.
Although travel was a lot lower and harder over a century ago, Charlie would come home whenever he got a long enough break in his busy schedule. And when he did, he was a popular and admired visitor. A star of his day.
The Derry Journal, July 1st, 1910. Delightful sports day at Bunkrana. During the day, the judges and other officials, without exception, attended to their duties most assiduously and had a genial and experienced referee in Mr. Charlie O'Hagan of football fame, who is well accustomed to dealing with big sporting gatherings. The local constabulary also lent useful aid in the carrying out of the programme. The following were the officials: Mr. William Doherty, J.P., P.J. McGoldrick and Charlie O'Hagan.
He used to come back to Bunkrana, and he apparently had great style when he came back to Bunkrana. He had a few sisters too, I'm not sure of their names. He had a brother who was a solicitor. I thought he was the Irish ambassador, but apparently he was the vice consul. And he had a brother, Johnny, who was the last left in the family. And apparently Johnny had a drink problem. My mother-in-law told me how Johnny had the drink problem was because he went out to get his other brother off the drink, and this Johnny boy became an alcoholic, and he ended up not well and living in the house, which would have been in its day a grand house.
According to the 1901 census, listed as living in the family home were 19-year-old Charlie, his mother Annie, two sisters and two brothers. His father had died a few years before this. Just 10 years later, in the 1911 census, they're all gone, except for Johnny. The business that had prospered so well for many years was gone too, and the fancy house was falling into disrepair. Alcohol seems to have been a problem in the family.
We went to Aberdeen in December 1906. Transfer fee was £175. He played for Aberdeen for about four seasons, and he was a big hit. During that time, he was in the Irish team.
Incidentally, Charlie features in the oldest surviving film footage of an international match in existence, all 90 seconds of it, when Ireland played Wales in Wrexham Racecourse Ground in 1906. Charlie's enjoying great success with Aberdeen and Ireland, which is still an All-Ireland team. But then he gets some tragic news about his brother James, who was in the fruit business in Liverpool.
Irish News and Belfast Morning News, 6th of January 1908. Charlie O'Hagan sustained a sad bereavement during the past week in the death of his brother at Bunkrana. The late Mr. O'Hagan was at business in Liverpool up to a couple of months ago, where failing health necessitated his return home. At a very important time, the New Year holiday matches, Aberdeen had to do without the services of their crack inside forward, who travelled to Bunkrana to attend the funeral.
You've got a family photograph album there. Maybe you can tell me about it.
That was in my mother's home, Cavendish in the main street in Bunkrana, and it seems they date back, like, here we have twice on the same page, the very front page, we have Charlie O'Hagan, September 1904, and then underneath it, he's done it the same thing again. He'd have been in Scotland playing the football, as far as I knew.
Did you know anything about Charlie or about this footballer growing up?
No, I didn't. I heard my mother talking about O'Hagan, Charlie O'Hagan, the footballer. And then my older sister Anna, who's now passed on, she used to go on about Charlie all the time, and one of her boys, Vincent, is very interested. He's dug out more stuff about him.
A month after the death of his brother, Charlie gets better news when he is rewarded for his excellent footballing form when he's appointed captain of Ireland.
Irish News and Belfast Morning News, 3rd of February 1908. Congratulations to Charlie O'Hagan on being selected to captain the Irish team on Saturday week. No player selected had better claims to the honour, and I'm sure the Bunkrana man will do justice to the confidence reposed in him by the selectors. A Scottish contemporary has the following regarding the Irish captain. The Aberdeen left wing, the best in the country or in either country, I think is capable of much wonder working.
Charlie went to Aberdeen, and that was the longest period of football he stayed with any club, and really, really successful at Aberdeen.
And he was the first captain international?
He was the first player to be kept at an international level for the Aberdeen club, which was a big thing in the day. Like, he left Aberdeen and still is held in high esteem now at Aberdeen. I was doing a bit of research on him even this year. Discovered that Charlie had done a bit of journalism with a newspaper in Aberdeen called the Bon Accord. And in the 2019-20 season, the Aberdeen club are now serialising some of those articles. So it shows you how esteem.
In one of his newspaper articles in later years, Charlie writes fondly about his time in Aberdeen and the role that the club played in his career.
Off to Scotland. I had conquered new fields prior to coming to the North East, and as I failed to rise to concert pitch here, I set about the task of shaking the dust off my boots, and this I did through the agency of a friendly Scot who told me that my proper place was among the boys beyond the Tweed. I was off towards the new El Dorado in a few hours' time, and I had no reason to regret it. In the North I seemed to have found a new lease of life. My first game was against the famous Light Blues, the Glasgow Rangers, and such a baptism in a new country and under totally different conditions was more than a test. It was more of a torture. My new team got beaten, but I had made the discovery that I had been seeking. I could play their game as one of themselves.
But despite his popularity at Aberdeen and his passion for the club, Charlie was restless again and seeking new challenges.
In September 1910, he went to Greenock Morton and played for them for 2 seasons. But actually, before he went to Greenock Morton, he basically had no club at the end of 1910 when he left Aberdeen. Belfast Celtic wanted to sign him. There's a couple of clubs in the Irish League. So he actually agreed to sign for Belfast Celtic. Now, he built into the contract that if another club, like a club in Scotland or England, came looking for him, he then would leave. In September 1910, Greenock Morton came looking for him.
After he left Aberdeen, he went to Greenock Morton and fairly scored a good lot of goals there as well. And then he spent a bit of time at Third Lanark. They're no longer in the Scottish League. But then, impulsively again, Charlie just retired.
But has he retired? Or is he simply between clubs, searching for his next opportunity? Also, in October 1911, Charlie takes over a pub in Greenock Morton, which he runs for a couple of years.
There's a record saying then in May 1913 that he went to Shelburne.
In Dublin?
Dublin, yeah. One of the paper articles I found. Now, I'm saying that, when he left Aberdeen, there's talk of him going to Bolton Wanderers, but Aberdeen wouldn't agree to the fee that Bolton wanted. So at the start of the 1913 season, that he'd be found in Shelburne Club in Dublin. But I have no record that he actually played for him. And then, because this says that he still owned the bar in Greenock Morton at the start of the First World War, so he might have been still running Bolton.
Like thousands of his fellow Irishmen, Charlie joins up to fight the Germans. The war lasts 4 years, and during it, he plays for his regiment in army tournaments. If the war hadn't happened, would Charlie have continued playing professionally? We'll never know. Charlie is 37 when the war ends. Fighting for the British will have serious consequences for Charlie later on.
He joined the Leinster regiment. He became a second lieutenant, and he saw how acting at the front. And you can imagine the carnage of the First World War. Like, he came back unscathed.
This is the record of him in the army here, 1915, and it says that Private Charles O'Hagan of the Irish Guards has been gazetted to second lieutenant and attached to the Leinster Regiment. Present quartered at the Curragh, Lieutenant O'Hagan, who was in business at Greenock, joined the Irish Guards after the beginning of the war. He was educated at the Collins College, Derry, was a noted athlete, having captained the Irish international football teams against England, Scotland and Wales. And he's the fifth son of the late Mr. James O'Hagan of Market Square, Bunkrana, and the younger brother of Philip O'Hagan, solicitor in East Wall and Derry. Having completed his training with the Irish Guards, he leaves there to take up his new duties
at the Cora.
What date is that again?
That is the Sustainable Day Journal, and that is March 31st, 1915.
A year before the
Easter Rising, a year before that. There's a picture of Charlie here as well. There's a lot of pictures of him in the newspapers as well.
Charlie survives the war, but then the trail goes cold for a couple of years until 1920, when he resurfaces under bizarre circumstances, accusing his former Aberdeen teammates of throwing a cup game, causing a major scandal at the time, an action he later regrets.
The Courier, March 4th, 1920. Charlie O'Hagan apology. The following advertisement appeared in last night's Aberdeen evening newspapers from Charlie O'Hagan, former Irish international and ex-Aberdeen player. Notice to the public, I, Charles O'Hagan, hereby declare that at a meeting of the Aberdeen Referees Association on Friday, the 20th of February 1920, I deliberately stated that in the semi-final of the Scottish Cup tie, Aberdeen versus Celtic at Pittodrie Park in March 1908, 9 members of the Aberdeen team accepted £15 each as a bribe to sell the match, only 2 members refusing to join in the deal. I now hereby declare that such statement was entirely false, malicious and slanderous, and I extremely regret having made it and now publicly withdraw it. Signed, Charles O'Hagan.
I always feel that the lack of information, it just fuels the sense of fascination.
Toronto-based sports journalist Owen O'Callaghan has written about Charlie O'Hagan for thejournal.ie. Over Skype during the coronavirus lockdown, he explains why he finds Charlie's story so appealing.
Because you don't know stuff for definite, and because there's these periods left out of someone's story, it adds to the mystique. Like in Charlie's case, you really wish that that's the version, but I'm really not sure. It could be quite a lot of sitting around twiddling your thumbs, waiting to figure out what your next plan is going to be, rather than, you know, bouncing from exotic location to exotic location. For such a fragmented life, it seems almost fitful rather than anything that's strategized or well thought out.
Charlie tried his hand at various things over the years, including administration, professional football, journalism and pub management. Charlie is about to embark on another new career.
The next part of his career would have been where he turned up as manager of Norwich. He became manager of Norwich, but he never was that successful. Like, he just done one season, and out of a total, I think it was 21 games, he had 4 victories, 8 defeats and 9 draws. I suppose percentage-wise, it wasn't the worst, but that was the start of his coaching career.
His managerial career was record 1920. He managed Norwich City, and there's some articles that a couple of young Irish players in the Irish League went to Norwich City, and some of the local papers were blaming Charlie for picking the young talent over to Norwich.
Charlie was Norwich's first professional manager, and there was much surprise when he got the job. Although a former professional club and international player, he had very little coaching experience and was selected over several much more qualified candidates. In any case, after a few months, in typical Charlie fashion, he's gone.
The Norwich managerial period is really a bit of a non-starter. I remember in the course of research for a piece I wrote, details were just so scarce. It's not as if you walk around Carroll Road and you tap someone on the shoulder and you say, Charlie O'Hagan, and they're going to know who you're talking about. Yes, he's part of history of a particular team, but you know, you have certain players, you have certain coaches who don't have a legacy with the team. You know, was it a case of Charlie feeling he was bigger than England? He wanted more, that he wanted a more glamorous, romantic notion. Certainly if you are trudging through a management career in Norfolk or in a harsh, weather-beaten northern Scotland, that doesn't really carry the same romantic notions as Seville or Berlin or New York.
Charlie disappears for a while again after his Norwich experience, only to grab the headlines with the news that he's off to Belgium.
Derry Journal, 4th of June 1923. Mr. Charlie O'Hagan, who is at present in Derry, has been appointed manager of a football team in Belgium. The club, to take charge for which he will soon leave Ireland, is to be congratulated on the choice of Mr. O'Hagan for this important position. He is admirably suited for it and will fill the role capably. Mr. O'Hagan does not go as a stranger to Belgium. When an international and playing for Tottenham Hotspur, he toured the continent with that team and played in Belgium. Then, during the war, he was in Belgian territory as a soldier. An able writer, he contributed extensively to the sporting newspapers in England and Scotland.
He actually managed a Belgium club in June 1923, and then in October 1923, he went then to Seville.
After a very brief spell in Belgium, Charlie takes on the manager's role at Seville. He's their first professional manager. But just like the Norwich job, there are questions over how he got it. There is some suspicion that Charlie supplied them with a somewhat embellished CV.
There wasn't a wide range of research that clubs tended to do when he's appointed Seville boss. There's so many inaccuracies in the profile that the club actually put forward. You know, there's a reference to him playing for Huddersfield. He never played for Huddersfield. You know, you also have to look at the historical context of it, the fact that the origins of Spanish football is so heavily influenced by British immigrants who effectively bring the game to certain parts of the country. And as a result, people with a British background are looked upon as being more educated and being more fully rounded in their knowledge of this sport. And I think in Charlie's case, that there's an element of legend versus reality. And I'm sure he wasn't going to get in the way of a good story. Maybe that's the element of the journalist at play there.
But there could be another explanation. Remember the time that Charlie worked for his brother's fruit company in Liverpool? They imported oranges from Seville, so did that play a role in him getting the manager's job?
I found out then that whenever Charlie got the job in Seville, I think it was around October 1923, I think it was, there was Mr. Evans, who obviously knew Charlie, and he had played for Seville, but he worked in a company, in Seville fruit company. So there's that connection. So the guy, Mr. Evans, called Charlie over. So there must have been a connection between fruit companies that Charlie once actually worked for.
My father said that when his football career ended, he went as a rep buying fine wines for the aristocracy of England.
When he was in London or Liverpool, he was working for a while for a fruit importing company that were importing Seville oranges. And the letter,
yeah, he said that he was in Spain buying wines for the aristocracy and that he watched them play football and they're so far ahead of us. The letters to me, grandfather and granny, he said he had a good number and he was doing okay and all that. Could be fruit instead of wine. People get carried away with different things.
From Sevilla. Now, La Liga hadn't been established in Spain at that time, but all the regions were getting themselves organized. They were kind of following the English model. In Andalusia, teams like Sevilla and Real Betis and a few teams they got, and they had kind of a money league there. And then they played in the Copa del Rey, which was the national cup. Charlie was pretty successful. He actually won the Andalusian Cup with Sevilla. They beat Real Betis in the final, which was a big one.
Charlie only lasted one season.
Yeah.
And there's always been some sort of mystery again as to why he didn't stay longer. But we reckon that they found an answer to that.
Well, basically he was fond of the red, of the wine. Probably there was a culture, probably in Ireland and in Scotland as well, played football. And maybe there was like an acceptable culture around alcohol. But maybe in Spain, the culture was different. So the story was he only lasted the year. Because he drank the wine or was fond of it, it was compatible with the job of a manager as well.
Alcohol was a problem in the family, although there's no definitive proof that Charlie had a drink problem. However, his nomadic lifestyle, restlessness and inability to hold down a job certainly wouldn't help.
I just heard that one or two brothers had a drink problem. The fella was a solicitor and the Johnny fella and maybe another fella, but I don't know his name. Maybe he might have been a teacher, but Charlie, apparently he seemed to have it too.
After his short time at Seville, Charlie heads home to Ireland. He's coaching and playing in the Irish League, but he can't resist the lure of another European adventure.
He's recorded then as being the manager of Ards in the Irish League in April 1924. At that time, Ards were top of the league in the Irish League. It's often reported that whenever he's seen the job for the Berlin management role, he was in Portrush. So maybe because he was actually managing the Irish League in Ards, he could have been up on holidays in Portrush. And that's where he seen the job advertised. August 1924, went to Berlin.
So he landed in Berlin and he got the job. But he wasn't in it very long. Things would have been still a bit raw because of the First World War and the fact that he fought for England. Just became uncomfortable and I don't think really got a chance there. But the German experience was his last football connection that I know of.
Charlie may have survived the war, but 6 years after it ends, it catches up with him. His experience in Germany would be humiliating and costly.
Mein Berlin, deine laufen Kolonien, da blühen die Veilchen und Geranien.
Aberdeen Press and Journal, August 25, 1924. Charles O'Hagan, the famous international footballer who 2 months ago accepted an appointment in Berlin as trainer, has returned to London penniless and disillusioned. A month after his arrival in Berlin, it was discovered that he had fought in the British Army, and this was followed by the tearing up of his year's agreement. It was all he could do to persuade them to give him a third-class ticket back to London. I would like, O'Hagan said, to warn any other Scottish footballers who have received tempting offers to go to Berlin to investigate them first before accepting. Otherwise, they will find themselves in a similar plight. My agreement proved worthless over there, and I could get no redress. I received a very favourable offer, which I accepted, with a Prussian club. For the first fortnight, I was treated well. Then petty jealousy started. I was called before the directors. They tried to bully me and asked me several insolent questions. Finally, I was asked if I had served in the British Army during the war, and I made no secret of the fact that I had served in France and Belgium. Without any more to do, I was told that my agreement must be considered cancelled. They told me to get out. I asked for my ticket back to Aberdeen or Portrush. At first, they would do nothing in the matter. Then they agreed to give me a ticket back to London and gave me the address of a man in Poplar. When I got to London, I went to Poplar only to find the man there knew nothing about me. The cost of going out there and buying the things I wanted has left me penniless.
Mein Berlin, deine laufen Kolonien, da blühen die Veilchen und Geranien.
Charlie eventually makes it back to Ireland, and the story goes quiet again for a time. He doesn't appear to be active in football, certainly not in a professional way. He's still doing some journalism work, securing a weekly column, the Northern Weekly Gazette in Scotland in 1927. And it's clear from his writing that his Berlin experience hasn't dimmed Charlie's enthusiasm for another crack at management in Europe.
A continental touch. I am told the Borough have arranged to visit the city I know at the end of the present season. They are due then at Copenhagen, the Danish capital. And if ever players require to have their sleeves rolled up, the boys who will wear the airsome colours that day, or days, must prepare to battle for their lives. And I know something of what happens when a crack British team bites the dust in foreign soil. I witnessed it happen so frequently that I grew to take it as a matter of course. Personally, I am building hopes of soon again going to the continent, for the lands across the Straits of Dover have an indescribable fascination for me, and I know every inch of the centres where good football is played on that wide expanse. Charles O'Hagan.
Charlie would set off on another adventure, but to America, not Europe.
From the shipping record, Charlie went over to a younger brother in November 1928, and the address that he gave was his brother's in New York.
I do have the shipping.
I have a shipping record here. Right? This is the manifest of the passengers. So it says that Charlie O'Hagan was 46 and he's listed as a sports journalist, and he's from Buncrana, but his last known residence was in Dublin. And then when he got to America, he listed his relative in America as Daniel O'Hagan, 36 West, 52nd Street. Going to America and they checked their health. Everything's given good here. There's no health issues or problems. He was 46. The record I have for the brother is he worked as like a butler.
Charlie's timing wasn't good. In 1929, less than a year after he landed in New York, the Wall Street crash plunged the United States and the world into the Great Depression. We could find no record of Charlie working as a journalist in the US, although that was his declared profession on entering it. Things evidently didn't go well for him there. His American dream was over.
When he would come home with all his style, he used to give these great friends some of his clothes. Later on in years when he became sort of down and out, these same friends didn't want to know him, and he was hurt by that. He wrote this in a letter. I saw the letter.
What all can you remember the letter said?
I remember the letter. And the person he wrote to was Rose Doherty, the miller, and said, "Dear Rose, I had to write to somebody today because I just received a letter from my daughter Nancy." And he was so overcome by it. He went on to say how the daughter had inherited some of his looks, especially his nose, and that he was now living in a convent. And his job, he said in the letter, looking after the flowers and looking after the altar. He must not have done well in America. And then maybe he went to a Catholic convent or home for refuge. Maybe that was all was for him.
Aberdeen Press and Journal, July 4th, 1931. Passing of Charlie O'Hagan. The death has occurred in Brooklyn, New York, of Charlie O'Hagan, the one-time Aberdeen and Irish international footballer. O'Hagan, who was an inside left, was for several seasons associated with Willie Lennie at Pittodrie, and the wing was the most famous and successful the club has ever had, and he remained at Pittodrie until 1909-1910. During that time, he was capped several times for Ireland. Later, he joined Greenock Morton, and was subsequently for a short time manager of Norwich City. In recent years, he had not enjoyed the best of health, and some time ago he went to America. He and Lennie were associated with some of the Aberdeen club's most notable performances, and as a wing combination, they were regarded as the finest of their time. O'Hagan had a style peculiarly his own. He was an expert dribbler with a capital shot, but his forte was in making openings for others. Of a bright and breezy disposition typically Irish, Charlie was a great favourite with football enthusiasts, and his death at a comparatively early age will be regretted by a large number of friends in Aberdeen and the north of Scotland.
The record then we had for Charlie when he died was his working as a porter.
You have that there. The death certificate's here, yeah. Right. Maybe we just read what we have now.
Right. It says here that Charlie went into hospital in New York on the 19th of June, 1931. And he died then at 10 past 10 in the morning on the 20th of June, 1931. And his illness is listed here as chronic pulmonary. Can't make out the last word there, but it's something obviously to do with the lungs. And it's given his date of burial as the 30th of June, 1931. And he's buried in the Most Holy Trinity Cemetery in the Bronx. Gives here his age as 49. And says his last occupation was a porter. Gives his address as 927 Third Avenue, New York City. And at the back of the death cert then, gives his next of kin, it gives his wife, Anne O'Hagan.
Although Charlie was married and had a daughter, he didn't seem to spend much time with them. There's very little mention of them anywhere. It appears they remained in Scotland while Charlie came and went. However, they seemed to be in contact towards the end of his life. Aside from newspaper articles, it's proven difficult to get copies of letters that Charlie wrote. Tony Tunney and Geraldine Gill explain.
He had a lot of stuff on him. His father made a scrapbook and he kept all his own football records. Now, he never let it out of the house.
Mostly about your father himself.
Mostly about his father.
Some would have been Charlie as well.
And Charlie O'Hagan and Dickie Doherty, Huey Dick with Celtic and all them. He kept right up to Christy Fletcher. Christy played with Kilmarnock and he played with Brentford. My father kept all these things. And he gave it to the photographer of the paper, the Daily Journal, and he told him to look after it because it's priceless and there's no second edition. And if the Daily Journal, if it didn't have a fire, then the whole lot was burned and lost forever. God was a wee mist.
There was a wake or something? What was that? What happened?
There was a wake in my granny's house. My Uncle Penny's wife died and there was a photograph of Charlie O'Hagan, an oval-shaped photograph. I seen a replica of it, much smaller replica that my father had in the scrapbook. And it was framed and on the hallway, a photograph of Charlie O'Hagan wearing his first international cap and holding a ball. And that photograph at the wake went missing. Somebody pinched the photograph at a car park. So one was stolen at the wake and the other one was lost in a fire. Actually, you don't know. Nobody knows.
Apparently there was a glass case in O'Hagan's house. And it had 11 caps in it that Charlie had got. And my mother-in-law used to always say she wondered whatever happened to the glass case to Charlie's caps. I don't know if anybody knows. Maybe years ago they wouldn't put any value on that stuff. Maybe they just threw it out. People just read out and throw everything out now. And some of the most valuable stuff, like wee letters written by people and all. But I did see the letter that Charlie O'Hagan wrote. And I'm just sorry now that I don't know where it is or whatever happened.
But what about Charlie's legacy? Is his story worth remembering? Owen O'Callaghan certainly believes so.
Charlie's story is astonishing. As much as there's the football side of it, he plays for his country, he goes to England and he develops a career and he builds up a reputation. That side of his story is something to get excited about. But for me, it's everything else on top of that. I think you have to be a completely unique personality type to have been brought up in Charlie's circumstances and want more. He was motivated by a sense of curiosity and adventure at a time in Irish society and Irish history when there wasn't much colour. Charlie O'Hagan's life was technicolour. I think that the greater success of his story is not be restricted by predetermined notions set by others. The notion of travelling to countries like Spain or continental Europe, he wasn't satisfied. Sometimes that can be a problem. You have to suffer the consequences, which he did. But I think it's very important that his story is told because he was doing things that nobody else at that time was doing. That stuff is Hollywood.
Tim McConnell will continue working to restore Charlie's reputation. We'll leave a last word to him.
The reasons I've been doing a number of projects on Charlie over the years to try and give him a legacy, because a lot of his exploits were unknown, but when you actually look on the CV, it's as good a CV as you would get anywhere. Like, you take a man, maybe starting kicking the football up the Bunk Grand on Main Street or in the Market Square, and they ended up in Sevilla and Andalusia, you know, it's a some journey.